This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield.
Now let's watch as they move the ball around until Big Jim Neal gets position on Mikan.
That sound from the 1954 NBA Finals. The players look as if they're moving in slow motion.
Finally, Mickelson, the third man, grabs the ball and it's a field goal for Minneapolis.
A few months after that game, the 24-second clock would be adopted by the NBA. Some say it saved the league. Our story begins with that clock and the man everyone believed developed it. Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
Danny Biasone was 83 years old on the day in 1992 when Sean Kirst, then a columnist for the Syracuse Post-Standard, came to visit him.
Danny was this tiny, indomitable force. When I met him, he was 2 weeks before death. He was in his bowling alley, which had remained unchanged since the days when he owned the Nats.
Biasone owned the Syracuse Nationals from 1946 to 1963, and he owned that bowling alley back then, too. The story Kirst had heard, the story everyone had heard, was that after a game one night, Danny Biasone scribbled calculations on the back of a napkin at the bar of his bowling alley and invented the 24-second clock. Kirst says Biasone never talked about the clock. He always called it the time.
He said that the game had become tedious and no one wanted to watch it because if one team got up by 10 points, they'd just stall the ball for the rest of the game. Danny said something had to change. You had to have a change in the time. So he never said, I came up with this idea.
Biasone didn't have to say he came up with the idea. Legendary Celtics executive Red Auerbach said it for him. Danny Biasone invented the 24-second clock by himself alone, Kirst quoted Auerbach as saying. I was at the meeting when he introduced it. He should get all the credit in the world for it.
So I wrote about that, and I get a call out of the blue from a woman who is very upset, who says to me, my husband was instrumental in creating the clock, and no one remembers him and no one believes it. And she was so upset. I wondered if it was for real. Some of my colleagues said that she had called before, and people sort of, to put this harshly, people kind of wrote her off as a crackpot.
Ever since he was a kid, Kirst had studied early basketball history, so the woman's claims got his attention.
I said, okay, Mrs. Ferris, I'll come out and talk to you. So I go out to this house in North Syracuse where this really gracious, wonderful person greets me. Tells me that her husband is dying of Huntington's and can't speak for himself.
Leo Ferris had a fatal genetic disorder. Some have said it's like dying of Alzheimer's, ALS, and Parkinson's all at the same time.
She brings out a paper bag and says, here's the clippings. And it's a paper grocery bag. And I start going through it, and in maybe a quarter of the way through, I pull out a newspaper that shows Leo Ferris with Ned Irish and these other giants of basketball in 1949 at the instant at which the NBA was created. It blew my doors off. It was like, holy smokes. And I had no clue. I apologized. I apologized on behalf of myself, and I apologized on behalf of all of the basketball hierarchy that had forgotten her husband and had disregarded her. I said, you know, you're right, and we're going to do something about this. And this thing really became more than just journalism to me. It became a quest for justice, historic justice, for this remarkable family that had been totally overlooked unfairly.
Around the same time, nearly 2,000 miles away, Christian Figueroa was growing up in Puerto Rico. Like many of his friends, he loved playing and watching basketball. One day, before he was 10 years old,
I was watching a basketball game. TV. It was definitely involving Michael Jordan, the Bulls. And my mother turned the corner and she started to watch the game with me. And she said, oh, do you know my Uncle Leo invented the shot clock? And I was like, what? Really? You never told me that.
Figueroa knew that his mother had been raised in upstate New York, but this was the first time she had mentioned her Uncle Leo, who was, of course, Leo Ferris. From then on, whenever she would catch her son watching an NBA game on TV, she'd share another story of her uncle and his connections with the league.
And, you know, I'd go to school and I'd say, hey, well, my great uncle invented the 24-second shot clock. And they'd turn around, my friends, and say, yeah, well, my grandmother invented the three-point line. And they just wouldn't believe me. And so I remember at an early age being frustrated by my lack of proof.
During the summers, Figueroa visited his mother's family in upstate New York, and that's where he met his Aunt Beverly, Leo's wife. She'd come to family reunions and bring an envelope filled with old photos and newspaper clippings. Figueroa hung on her every word. It must have been a relief for Beverly Ferris to find such a receptive audience. Leo was growing weaker by the day. Along with her daughter Jamie, Beverly provided all of Leo's care at home. And she still hadn't found anyone other than journalist Sean Kirst, who believed her.
She fought many years, even when he was still alive, even when her daughter was getting sick. She fought and fought to get the truth out. I can't even imagine how difficult that must have been for her.
Decades later, Christian Figueroa would pick up where his great aunt left off. Meanwhile, Sean Kirst was digging into the stories Beverly Ferris had told him, finding corroboration the best way he knew how.
Sitting with a lever at a microfilm machine in the back room of a library and reading clips and just going day by day and reading the things, because in the old days they reported everything.
Kirst says if not for Leo Ferris, the NBA as we know it might never have been formed. Back in the 1940s, there were two rival pro basketball leagues. The NBL, founded in 1937, played in mostly smaller cities, and the BAA, which came along to challenge the NBL in 1946. Ferris was the co-founder and GM of an NBL team, the Buffalo, later Tri-State Bisons. Ferris and the other NBL executives knew their league couldn't survive if it had to compete with the BAA, so...
So they make him president of the NBL with the mission to be force a merger with the BAA.
Leo Ferris did what smart league presidents do. He outbid the BAA for the best players coming out of college. But then he came up with a crazy idea. Why settle for signing one college player at a time when he could sign a whole college team?
Kentucky had a team that they called the Fabulous Five, and he creates a franchise for them. He says, if you guys come to our league, you can have the Indianapolis franchise. It'll be your team. That is the move that broke the BAA's back. They say, okay, that's enough.
That old black and white photo Beverly Ferris showed Sean Kirst on that afternoon back in 1992 was taken on August 3rd, 1949, the day the two leagues merged to form the NBA. Five men stand smiling, their hands stacked on top of each other. Ferris is in the middle. His left hand rests on the top of the pile.
So you can argue that if a meteor had fell on Leo at that moment, he should be in basketball's Hall of Fame. But he doesn't stop there. That's what's so cool.
Sean Kirst had gotten at least one thing absolutely right in his story about Syracuse Nats owner / bowling alley operator Danny Biasone.
Danny said something had to change. You had to have a change in the time.
The idea of a shot clock was already out there, but how much time should be on it? Leo Ferris did the math. By 1954, he was the general manager of Biasone's team. Looking over box scores from games that had been hard-fought and exciting, he and Biasone counted an average of 120 shots, roughly 60 by each team. It was Leo Ferris who took pen to napkin at the bowling alley bar. The game is 48 minutes long. 48 minutes equals 2,880 seconds. Divide that by 120 and you've got the 24-second shot clock. Leo Ferris, not Danny Biasone, presented the clock to the Rules Committee meeting. All of this is documented in old newspaper clippings.
Just to give you the importance of this thing, Bill Himmelman, the NBA historian for many years, once said, there are two moments of importance in basketball history. There's the moment when Dr. Naismith nails a peach basket to the wall, and there's the moment when they turn on the 24-second clock.
Leo's role in all of this, the shot clock, the formation of the NBA, and more, was thoroughly reported in the Post-Standard and other newspapers of the day. So why, when Beverly Ferris called the sports desk 40 years later, did no one believe her story?
He did all this before he was even 39 years old. He left the game at 38 years old.
That was just months after the shot clock was introduced. Christian Figueroa says it would take decades before anyone realized the importance of the things Leo Ferris had done.
By then, he was sick, and by then, he was decades out of the game, and by then, history had been rewritten, frankly.
Leo Ferris died in 1993 after a 25-year battle with Huntington's disease. Beverly Ferris died in 2010 without seeing her husband recognized for his achievements. Leo and Beverly's daughter, Jamie, also inherited Huntington's. Figueroa visited her before her death in 2014.
And even as all her muscle functions were deteriorating, she still would talk about him. She would come alive when she got to talk about Leo. When she passed in 2014, it got me thinking about another family member passed, another family member who knew Leo, another family member that had fought for Leo.
Not every family would have fought so hard. Some might have felt that Leo's post-NBA career in real estate was enough evidence of a life well lived. But for Beverly and Jamie, recognition was everything. By the time his cousin died, Christian Figueroa had a son of his own, a son who loved basketball. And Figueroa decided it was his turn to pick up the fight to set straight his family's legacy.
So this is for Leo, for Aunt Beverly, this is for cousin Jamie, and for all the people who suffer and have suffered from Huntington's disease.
And while the Basketball Hall of Fame hasn't recognized Leo Ferris yet, Sean Kirst says it's just a matter of time.
How could any fair person hearing our conversation here today, how could you say, you know, that he doesn't belong in there? That this thing is happening, that a great nephew in Boston embraces the cause of this forgotten upstate basketball pioneer, it's just a joyous story, and I hope it has a joyous culmination.
Since our story first aired, Christian Figueroa and the other champions of Leo Ferris have had some success. Last October, Leo Ferris was inducted into the Greater Syracuse Hall of Fame. Christian Figueroa says that the induction ceremony was lovely and attended by more than 1,000 people, including many members of Ferris's family and even some of Beverly Ferris's former co-workers. But just last weekend, Leo Ferris was once again left off the list of Basketball Hall of Fame inductees. It's the third year in a row that Ferris was nominated and not inducted. Our story was produced and reported by Only a Game's Karen Given.